One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
How can we rethink religion through a lens of progressive science and evolutionary consciousness? In this conversation, I speak with Sister Ilia Delio. It's not her official title, but I have decided to call her a theologian futurist. She's a Franciscan sister and one of those fascinating people who has doctorates in the fields of both theology and science. She explores how many of the things religion holds onto are outdated and run the risk of relevance. She believes that every seminary curriculum should include Big Bang cosmology, evolution, quantum physics, and neuroscience. In this incredible conversation, we talk about the intersection of scientific discovery, evolution, technology, artificial intelligence, and religion, and go deep on the many possible ways we might understand what the notion of God could be. For those of you who might have deeply held ideas about certain things, this might be one of the more challenging, wiser conversations for you to engage with. So dive in.
When our understanding of nature has shifted, we need to reframe the sacred dimensions of life and therefore the religious dimensions of life. And unless religions do that, you know, people will look for spiritual values in other ways, and it will not be in the institutional religions.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wiser Conversations, Together at Home. My name is Derek Handley. I'm an entrepreneur, an investor, a teacher, and a student. Each episode, I sit down live with an amazing thinker, an author, an artist, a religious or spiritual leader. We have a conversation to reflect on our lives and the world around us in these very surreal times. With all the uncertainty, there is no better moment than now to reflect on what matters to us and who we wish to become as we see out this pandemic. Welcome. This conversation took place with a live online audience of tens of thousands around the world. Sign up at wiserconversations.org to participate live in the future. You may not know, but New Zealand last year became a country that more than half of the population in the census for the first time identified as being non-religious. So it's really one of those countries that's kind of moving away from organized religion. When you talk to people, you know, they often say, "Yeah, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, but I don't believe in God." And I always find this really interesting, because what I think they mean is, I don't believe in that painting that I see in my head of this old dude with really long white hair who points his fingers and leans down towards you and over you. And somehow, how have we got kind of landed with this image that now means that millions of people will just say, "Oh, no, I don't believe in that," and therefore I've dealt with that box, and therefore I'm not really considering that as an option anymore in any other form, which I think is super fascinating. And in all the work that I've read and heard you talk about, it's like, wow, there are so many other ways to think of what that might be. So I thought I'd start there.
Yeah, great question, Derek. Yeah, because I have a lot of students who say the same thing. I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. And, you know, that's what they begin the class like that. I'm like, okay, fine. I'm not religious either in that way. I mean, the big guy in the sky, you know, the old granddad watching over us, That we can attribute, I think, largely to medieval art, you know, and the many images that art, you know, portrayed of this elderly male figure. And then coupled with that, you know, a God who gets angry with us, a God who judges us, a God who allows, you know, bad things to happen to good people. Who would want a God like that, right? You know, and unfortunately, I think it's a real distortion, you know, certainly of the Christian God that we've really politicized, if I can say that, you know, for the last number of centuries. And I think a lot of our work today, certainly my work, is trying to rebirth God. And so I think part of the thing is, you know, just the name God is a name. It points to an inexpressible mystery, you know, an incomprehensible mystery, and yet a deep presence that we know, we feel it, you know, we feel that, we experience that presence, that mysterious presence. And so one thing is, you know, I think we can realize that maybe the name God weighs us down or thwarts our lives. Find another name for that mystery, you know. Is it love? Is it compassion? Is it goodness? I don't know. Is it aliveness? But we need a name that we can relate to, because it's about a relationship. And that's really what religion's about. Religion is about relationality to the, you might say, to that which binds us, that which gets us up in the morning, you know. What are we bound to? That's the question of religion. You know, who do we ultimately belong to? What gives fire to our lives? You know, I mean, during this pandemic, you know, why get up in the morning when we have more bad news? You know, we have more deaths. And, you know, we know that this virus isn't the end of life, that there's something more to life. And religion is about the moreness of life. Mm. And God, the name God, is the name of that moreness that monotheistic faith, certainly Christianity in particular, has given, you know, a name to. But I think we have really, we have made that name into a big being. You know, like God's a big one of us.
Yeah. So it's like he's got a bit of a branding, or she has a bit of a branding issue, especially for younger generations who are dropping out of organized, as like we said in New Zealand. I think it's really, I would love to come back to this whole idea, but I think it's really interesting to go back in time for you. I know you started as a scientist, right? I think you have, I might have this wrong, but I think you have a doctorate in both theology and in the sciences and pharmacology and all sorts of interesting science. How did you go from there into theology? And I think this combination gives you this totally unique view on the world in which you've constructed all your thinking and writing and talking, which is fascinating.
Well, I love science. I have to tell you, I've always loved science. I love the details of life and the way they work. I love the creativity of nature. So I actually believed for the longest time that science would lead us to truth. It was the knowledge we needed for a better life. And, you know, there's still, you know, I still adhere to a lot of what science has to offer us. So I did get a bachelor's, a master's, and a doctorate. In biology, in the biologies, and then in physiology, and then in pharmacology. So my area was neuroscience, actually. I was in the spinal cord research area. I had a postdoc at Johns Hopkins University that I gave up because I came across the life of Thomas Merton, this monk who wrote this fabulous book called The Seven Story Mountain. And I saw my life in Merton's life, and I just thought, that's really what I want to do, you know. So I gave up a career in research science and found myself in a very strict monastery. And then I said, once the drugs wore off, then I wondered how I was going to get out of the monastery. So, you know, I For one thing, I think being raised in a world of science, in a world of research science, I'm not afraid of science. In fact, I want to hear what science has to say to us because it's our best knowledge of how nature works. You know, otherwise we have contrived ideas about nature, and sometimes they're so romantic and idyllic that, you know, we lose touch with the fact that, you know, we live in an open systems type universe where chaos, disorder, emergence, complexity are part of the stuff of life. And I think this is where I think theology has sort of gone off course. It doesn't really pay attention to what science is really telling us. And I think it's been very enriching for me. It's not a path I would have chosen, quite honestly, to first get a doctorate in science and then get one in religion.
When you encountered the monastery, when you kind of moved from, you know, that life of science and you almost collided in that sense by choice, I mean, I imagine you must have come up against things where your science background and brain would be looking at things going, well, how do we reconcile certain things that people are struggling to recognize by not thinking about science? And of course, you go back in your talks to, you know, Copernicus and Kepler and all those historical situations that create that schism in the beginning.
Right. I mean, you know, the one thing I think when I went to the monastery, I had to move from my left brain to my right brain, so to speak. I was so used to analyzing things and thinking through logically about things that I could not. You know, if we talked about the incarnation or Jesus, you know, for example, like God becomes flesh, I'm thinking, well, what does that mean, you know, in terms of divine nature and human nature, and how could you possibly bring these two things together? So I think I put, quite honestly, the way I handled things my own way is I had to put science on hold and really enter into theology or the life, you know, religious life, monastic life, and all that it had to offer. And maybe that was a good thing to do because I didn't allow science to kind of, I wasn't constantly measuring what I was learning in the spiritual life against what I knew from science. I just put science to the side for a second, you know, moment. And then I just entered into what the desert fathers and mothers had to tell us. And it's a very rich spiritual tradition, you know, that Christianity has to offer. It's really when I started studying theology and medieval theology, I began to see the medievalists were fascinating in terms of bringing the big cosmos and the human person together. They were natural philosophers, you know, and so their observations of the cosmos, their understanding of astrology, and then bringing that together with the things of faith, that was my first opening that science and religion could actually work together. It was actually in medieval theology.
But that interplay and that conversation between science and theology has informed a lot of where you've headed in the past, you know, decade or so in terms of evolution and now even quantum physics, things like that. Share where you're at on how those worlds collide at the moment and, you know, complexity and consciousness for you, the whole chain kind of seems to daisy chain together. Can you... We're all lay people. Tell us the story.
So, you know, one of my guides to this story, the new narrative, what I might call a new narrative, is the Jesuit scientist Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And he was a Jesuit and yet a paleontologist by training. And he wrote a lot because he had, you might say, he saw the relationship between Christianity and evolution in a coherent way. And he really tried to, in his writings, show how these two things actually work together. And so using Teilhard's insights, I've tried to build an understanding of religion within an evolutionary age, and especially in terms of artificial intelligence. I see, first of all, let me say, I see none of these things as being incompatible, but rather they're an integrating whole. So I take science as sort of one dimension of the reality, and I take religion. By religion, I don't mean a narrow institutional religion. I mean that that energy of connectivity, to ultimate meaning and value. That's my broad definition of religion. And so beginning to understand these, you know, science and religion within the context of evolution has put a whole new understanding on God, on the question of Jesus as the Christ. And artificial intelligence is a continuation of an evolutionary movement towards greater consciousness and greater complexity. That's something that Teilhard noted in his own lifetime. It's not, you know, again, in terms of science, it's a very complex, you know, a complex area. But as a pattern, so evolution as a pattern of change and movement is, if you stand back, you can just look over time from, you know, the smallest of life on Earth, you know, from bacteria to the emergence of Homo sapiens sapiens. And certainly, I mean, anyone who takes evolution seriously would have to say, well, we're certainly not the end point. Like, we're not the ta-da, you know, we're not the final two words of the sentence with a period after us. We are in evolution. That is the beauty of the whole thing. And that's where religion, I think, has really gone off course. It has stayed in a static, fixed cosmology, and therefore, metaphysically, it's rather static, which makes God the fixed guy in the sky idea. And so it's our problem, you know, that we cannot accept change as part and parcel of what a divine dimension to life might be for us, like a God of change. Like, maybe God changes. Maybe God's in evolution, you know.
What do you think the response should be to that, you know, in terms of the idea of, well, if these frameworks are fixed and they refuse to evolve, or they get dragged through as opposed to kind of ushering things in or seeking them, how do you propose that gets rethought?
Well, I think the first thing is that I think religion needs to pay attention to what science is telling us fundamentally about nature. It is our best teacher of nature. It may not tell us in terms of values, but it tells us how nature works. And that's really important, right? So if you go back to the doctrine of creation from Genesis, like, you have God and creation. Okay, well, the only way we can know about this God, quote unquote, is from creation, right? There's no God apart from human consciousness, right? So we can't even entertain that notion of God apart from human understanding and consciousness. So if nature changes, then it gives us insight. Well, if nature is this way, then maybe God is also changing. Maybe God is, you know, God and nature always work together. So you can't have one variable change and the other remain fixed. They work in tandem, right? So if evolution is the best description of nature, it gives us insight into what God is like. Maybe this is a God who certainly is at home in a world of change, certainly at home in a world of chaos. Well, then maybe God doesn't have the whole plan, you know? Maybe God doesn't really know, you know, what this future is going to be. Maybe God is acting with us to create this world unto what it has the potential to be. And that's the type of thinking religious people are reluctant to embrace. There's something about, you know, the way religious myths and narratives have created frameworks of stability that people find comfort in. Yet those stable frameworks are the very frameworks that thwart sometimes a more flourishing life on the planet. And so, you know, what Teilhard de Chardin tried to do is try to get us to understand that, you know, faith and evolution are not in conflict. They can work very nicely together. And we might have to adjust our understanding of God, but that's only so that we have a more, when I say reasonable, a credible God and not an incredible God. You know, we don't want a Zeus in the sky. We want a power of divinity that empowers us from within. You know, that's our future. That is about life. And I think, you know, that's a lot of my work is trying to restructure that God-world relationship in terms of a God of life, right? Mm. You know, that what we're about is life and life together on this planet.
How do you think we're going with that transition?
Not too well. I have to admit. You know, and several problems. One, and it's not just Christianity. I think all religions are complicit in this kind of static, we're not going to change, you know, idea. Well, get over it, okay? You know, like, really, the past is behind us. The only thing we have together is our future. The future belongs to all of us, and it's our binding force. And therefore, I think, you know, if religion has something vital to offer, and by vital, I mean this, the energy of spirituality. By spirituality, I mean the energy of deep connectivity, the values that come with that, the values of compassion, the values of mercy, the values of love, you know, a love that seeks the good of the other, you know, beyond the self-sufficient self, a value of forgiveness, the values of peace. And all world religions, truthfully, have these values within them. Our problem is, you know, why don't we harness these values into maybe a new, now Teilhard called for a new religion of the earth. And maybe what we do need is a new type of religion. Maybe what we do need is a post-institutional religion that really enlivens these values, calls us back into community. Mm. And maybe we need new narratives, new myths, new stories that bind us together in a new way. But if we keep holding on to the past, we are constantly thwarted in the deepest energies to unite and to grow together into something new.
You know, most of the conversations we have on Wiser are to do with how to, well, we try to make them to be about how to be in the world, how to behave in the world, how to live, and less about the theoretical or kind of macro things that you can't say, okay, well, how does that relate to my everyday being in the world? And I would love to explore that. I have seen somewhere you're speaking about being as being inseparable from kind of, well, you can't be on your own. You must be with others. You must be in relation to others. And that also reminded me, I was just doing some research a couple of weeks ago, and I found that the Japanese word for people is ninjen, which is like person, but the second part is being with, so in relation to, which I thought was fascinating that in their word for the person, it's stripped away the idea that the person can exist on its own.
Right. Well, you know, the word person actually means relational being. It comes.
Oh, there you go.
Sonare, right? To sound through. And I always distinguish a person from an individual. I think we are individuals on our way or seeking to become persons. I don't want to presume that we're persons. We have the capacity to be person. That means we have the capacity to be the relational beings that we truly are. But we're always thwarted. You know, we're always sort of partially there. And I think, you know, how do we grow into personhood? Teilhard actually thought, you know, two things. One, he said, love is the core energy of the universe, and personhood is what we are created for, as if the whole universe is one giant person in formation. So, you know, if you can imagine, just imaginatively, imagine the whole globe forming as one transhuman or one cosmic person. I mean, the internet just gives us a little glimpse into what the capacity of that could be, right? Shared consciousness, shared, you know, shared feeling for what's happening in parts of the world. So yeah, being with is perfect. I love that Japanese word. So thank you for that. That we are, you know, David Bohm, the quantum physicist and contemporary of Einstein said, you know, in his book on implicate order, he said, you know, we seem separate and we act separate, but this is an illusion. And I think that's really true. I think we are constantly living between the illusion of separateness and the deep desire for relationality, for wholeness. For wholeness, I mean, the deep belonging to, the deep connectivity of our own beingness. And so he says, you know, we seem separate, but in our cosmic roots, we are already one. And there's something about that, you know, I always say, no matter where you go in the world, no matter what language, no matter what religion or no religion, the one thing that binds us is the human heart. And when you speak to the heart, the language of love, you have a sister and a brother, no matter where you are in the world. You know yourself to be related because it's something that's deeper than those intellectual arguments we, you know, devise in our left brain, you know, that, well, you're this, you know, are the judgments that we make. The way we sort of box people in into categories, and then we dismiss them because they don't fit into our privatized world. And I think, and I do think we're on the cusp of moving out of privatization and isolationism. And I think if we have any blessings in this COVID pandemic, it is the realization that we need one another. We belong to one another. People are longing for social beingness again, right? For relationship. Mm-hmm. We could build on our deep relationality. It's together that, you know, together that we find life. When we are alone, we always have a whiff of life, but never the fullness of life. Life flourishes when, you know, there's shared being. So I always describe, you know, my definition of love is not looking at one another, but looking together in the same direction. And I think that's what we're created for.
You think in the last, you know, decades, we have been creating things that make us more separate and, you know, building higher fences around our houses and creating our own, you know, compounds of life and bubbles. And where do you think that's come from, and how do you think we untangle from it?
Yeah, I think we have developed a deep fear of one another. We have developed mindsets. We have developed sort of little Newtonian worlds, you know, where my little atomized life is my stability, and here's, you might say, the self-thinking subject writ large, you know, that, you know, what I think is what I am, and the I has a big role in all this. So relationships in that kind of understanding are just more extrinsic to me. Like, if I want to be your friend, fine. But if I don't want your friendship, I really don't care about you, you know? And so this kind of, you know, looking out for number one thinking. And that has been we're the most unhappy people, you know, on earth. And here's where I think we can learn from nature. You know, I always say the trees don't say to the flowers, God, you know, you're so ugly. You know, you're so yellow. I hate yellow. You know, there's a beauty in nature. There's a harmony and a synergism of distinctiveness. So it's actually in our distinct beings that we participate in the beauty of the whole. And we have built walls around distinct beings, because if you don't look my way, if you're not my color, if you're not my religion, you're not my language, I don't want anything to do with you. And we have fractured, we have splintered our world into 1,000 pieces, and we're miserable because of it. Really miserable, because we know deep down inside we belong. We are made to belong to this whole and to one another.
In this, going back to where we were talking about this evolution of religion itself, how can such an evolution and a reframing help heal that fracturing, or help rebuild that interconnectedness and that way of being?
I do think the best of religion is about connectivity, the best of it. And by that, I mean, it's about, if I just take the Judeo-Christian tradition, which is the one I know best, it's about covenant, it's about relationality. I mean, the Old Testament, for all the, and there's a lot of war, there's a lot of violence in the Old Testament, you know, don't get me wrong, but this is a God who doesn't give up. You know, this is the God who says, I am with you always. You know, you strayed away, but I am here. Deep compassion, a compassionate God. How do we How do we reclaim and find anew a compassionate God? And here I think the Christian message has something to offer, because I don't think we've really understood what this Jesus Christ really means for us, the incarnation. This is a God who gives up being God to be God for us. You know, this is a God who gives God's self completely to us. And we have no idea what that means. I mean, how could God give God's self away and still be God? You know, that's our big question. It's one of those conundrums. But that is the mystery of God, right? That's the mystery of love. It's an unquenchable love, an incomprehensible love that can give itself totally to us, to be with us in hiddenness, humility, patience, perseverance, an empowering love that says, I will be with you through death. I am with you through darkness. I am with you and I suffer with you, but I will not abandon you. That kind of God. How do we know that God? Because we meet that God when we meet a person of compassion, when we find ourselves loved, even though we've gone astray, you know, we did wrong. There's no other God up there. That's not here. That's the whole point. And there's something about us, like we can't get our heads around, like, what? Like, that God is in me? Like me? Like my little life? I'm like, yeah, your little life. Your little life has infinite value. Infinite value. You are the love of God now, you know? Your words, your gestures, the way you reach out, the way you can hold a door for someone. And the same thing, you reject that God when you reject another person, when you say, I hate you. You know, I hate what you have to say. You slam the door in God's face, basically. And when we cut God out of the picture, when we cut divine love out of the picture, then we are left to fend for ourselves. We are left with the cold, sterile, you know, being that we are.
What you share sounds like a lot like divinity in all things. All things not necessarily being divine, this kind of pantheism versus panentheism picture. Share more on that.
Yes. Well, I do think a little good pantheism can go a long way. You know, I mean, I think one of the things what we have done is kept this God at a very safe distance, you know, like this transcendent God, the one up there, but there's no there. Okay. The only there is here. And I think we need to reframe transcendence as fecundity, that there's an excess, an overflow of divine love. No one person or being can contain that love. It's always a more. And that's why it's always pulling us and pulling everything into more life. And therefore, I think, you know, the only God that there is, the God there is here. Teilhard spoke of a Christian pantheism. And I'm not, you know, entirely for Spinoza's God, you know, but I do think that there's an allness, that the divinity is in all things, and all things are sharing in this divine life. I don't think God's waiting for us to get it right before God becomes our God. I think God's like, well, okay, here we are, you know, so let's work at this together. And so I think we are not awakened to the divine dimensions of our lives. We're pretty sure we don't have a divine dimension, and we have to make our way through this fallen, sinful world to get, you know, to be rewarded by the big guy in the sky. And that's just the worst thing possible. That's every environmental crisis you could ever possibly imagine, right? You know, no, instead of saying, no, the whole point of the incarnation is to be God, not only for us, but with us and in us and through us, God will become something more. That is the Christian message. It's not just that we're changing, but God also, we actually contribute something to God. We make a difference to God's life because we're pretty sure God doesn't change. And I'm saying, guess what? I think God actually changes. You know, the God became us. That was a change, right? But, you know, theologians have this way of dancing around. They say, no,
how do you, is that kind of just trying to process this? Is it almost like the creation process itself, or the process of creating the newness, the cusp that we're always on, which is creating the next moment and the next moment and the next day and the next thing? And whether that's from an industry to the internet to artificial intelligence, or from me being 5 to 7 to 47, is that process part of what you're saying is, you know, God itself?
Exactly. God is creativity. Love is creative. I mean, if you love does new things, right? I mean, even two people who fall in love, if it was static and sameness, it becomes mechanized, it becomes rote, and it falls out of love, right? Where there's love, there's creativity. Where there's creativity, there's new life. So God is the newest thing there is. God is the most creative, the ground of creativity itself. And so, you know, as Alfred Whitehead said, you know, when we are part of creativity, we are part of divine life. Mm. And that's what immortality is, according to Whitehead. You know, we'll be part of an ever creative
changing
process.
Flow. It sounds a little bit like there is some real parallels in what you're saying with some aspects of the Taoist ideas of flow and creativity and constant moving, almost like waterway that just flows through existence, and that version.
I do. I think that we would find a lot of resonance. I think we should bring East and West together in these conversations, because there's a tremendous richness from the Asian religions that we have really ignored in the West, quite honestly. Mm. And they're much more ancient, and they have really contemplated these things. I think what we're just saying here is that this creativity is moving towards it's an ever rising creativity of expanding consciousness. That's the beauty of it. There's something without losing materiality, materiality itself, because I take materiality as, you know, where consciousness is expressed. So I don't take these as two separate things, but intertwined, a kind of panpsychism, if you will. The whole of material life is moving towards greater consciousness, and it's doing so by creativity.
So let's go from there to AI. So when we had a brief chat before, you sounded almost like a venture capitalist. You know, I love Silicon Valley. I love technology. I love the future. And you're almost like making bets on the future of theology. So AI is, you know, we're on the cusp, this generation, this life, this century, it will be totally different, right? When I'm an old man, if I have the good fortune of staying or getting to that age, it will be real. And the stuff you're talking about now will hit hard into theology. It will really collide into what we thought life is, what we think life is. Oh, that's not natural. That whole idea of what is natural is going to be really challenging. So what are your thoughts when you think about AI and crystal ball, and you think, wow, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, what's possible? What opens up in your mind?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that we will be a new type of species. I do think we're on our way to becoming techno sapien, cyber sapien. We're already there in some ways. We're already cyborged. You know, I do foresee, I mean, certainly as robots are being developed and interspersed into, you know, Homo sapien life, that they'll be driving our cars, they'll be, you know, perhaps housemates, they're making coffee, everything else. But even more so, you know, I do foresee that we'll have implantable software, you know. And here's the thing, you know, transhumanism is...
Can you define that for a minute?
Is the use of technology to enhance life. So living longer, living healthier. Some advocate for overcoming the death barrier, digital immortality. And so, you know, it scares a lot of people, and it says we don't want to go there. But the fact is, we're already on the cusp of being, you know, on transhumanism. And the fact is, we don't stay still. There's something about us that has a transcendent dimension. We are always moving beyond where we are, because we're always trying to maybe improve what we are, you know, this idea of perfectibility. But, you know, is there a way we can develop technology or artificial intelligence that can enhance our deep relationality? So there's a lot of discussion around social media, for example, like Sherry Turkle's work or Nicholas Carr, that says it's making us less human. We're becoming more isolated. We are lonelier than ever. Well, that's true in some ways, because we have developed this at a very rapid rate. We have not really reflected on what we want with our technology. And we haven't really developed a framework of values with technology. Like, how might we develop technology towards, say, interplanetary life? How might we use technology to deepen love, to deepen compassion, to deepen peace in the world? So you can't have an unbridled development of technology. It can't be all based on how much money Google's making and Microsoft is making. I mean, that's where I do think I think religion, philosophy, ethics all need to be involved in the discussions on technological development. AI is not the problem per se. We are developing AI, we humans. And the question is, what is driving this development? Why do we do this? You know, and we've done it at such a fast rate over the last 60 years. I mean, Google's only with us, you know, about 20, 30 years. It's not that old. And yet it has radically changed our world. And we haven't been prepared for it. And I think that's part of our dilemma. We're on this breathless pace with technology. So why don't we slow down technological development and think about how AI could actually enhance our life together, enhance divinity among us, you know? I do think post-human life, which is, so I see an emerging type of person on the horizon with technology. We're actually rewiring. I think that's not like a novel idea, because the brain just interacts with the environment. And as the environment, you know, as the milieu shifts, the brain will adjust accordingly. So we have, I do think young generations, they are wired for interplanetary life. They're already communal before they're individual. You know, they're interested and they're concerned with global poverty and injustice. Older people are like, oh, I don't know if I want to get involved in that. You know, they already think like as an individual, and they have to get involved in a community. So you can see that there's been a switch between personhood and community, or individual community, between older and younger generations. And technology will continue to do that for us. Mm-hmm. And I do think over time, we will find ourselves in a different logic of personhood that will actually be better. We will think in terms of interbeing, intersubjectivity, interrelatedness. And so I actually think we're on the cusp of a much better world, believe it or not, with technology.
As individuals and as a community, what about how it collides with the notion of, you know, traditional religion or the church or those infrastructures that you've already said and we've already spoke about are kind of slower to change?
They have to change, quite honestly. And I think, you know, the resistance to change, and I understand these are long traditions, and they can't just like tomorrow just decide by a fiat, it's all over and we need to reboot. Although I think something of that wouldn't be so bad, quite honestly. They just don't work. You know, religion, you know, Bronislaw Sierzynski, a British sociologist, actually wrote a book on nature and the sacred. And he said, you know, when our understanding of nature shifts, the sacred also shifts. And he was exactly right. That's exactly what's happening. You cannot keep old paradigms, old religious paradigms, when our understanding of nature has shifted. We need to reframe the sacred dimensions of life, and therefore the religious dimensions of life. And unless religions do that, they will be, you know, people will look for spiritual values in other ways, and it will not be in the institutional religions. They have a choice to make. You know, you either wake up and get with the program, or you suffer the death of the institution. And that's just the way it's good. I mean, hey, welcome to evolution. You know, you won't be the first institution to die out.
What do you think are some examples of ways people are already, you know, if they're leaving or they never went to religious institutions, finding spirituality in other ways. When you think around and you look at culture, pop culture, the zeitgeist, how do you see people finding that spiritual, filling that spiritual bucket elsewhere?
I think movements, and I think organizations like Richard Rohr's Center for Action and Contemplation is a way where, you know, people who are not spiritual but not religious can plug into. People find groups, you know, and the only thing is, and here's my only plug for, you know, institutionalized religion, is that in a world as fluid as ours, you know, where communities, you know, you say, I can plug into this community, it gives me life, it gives me values, and all of a sudden something goes wrong, you know, or, you know, and then you're like, well, I'm out of here. So there's a great fluidity. And actually that could be counterproductive. Because it becomes a new type of individualism, right? If it doesn't meet my needs, I'm out of there. And that's the only, you know, one of the advantages of institutional membership or being committed. You know, I think that's how do we foster, and I'm not just rooting for the institution, but we need sort of there's something about these long traditions, you know, that, you know, there's been a commitment to this tradition over time. There's something about that that's worthwhile. And we shouldn't toss out too quickly, because we may long for those spiritual values, but if they don't meet our needs, we're gonna move on to something else. Where, you know, a lot of what we seek, if we remain committed to a community or to a religious tradition, and we kind of persevere through it, because a lot of what we're looking for will take a fair amount of suffering, right? You need perseverance. There's a role of suffering in that movement to a higher love. To a higher level of personhood, and my only concern is that we want to dissociate ourselves from suffering or from having to make too many sacrifices. So institutional religions have these dimensions. They need to reframe, and the one thing I think they need to do is accept evolution. For Christians, I think, you know, one of the things would be helpful would be to put original sin to bed. You know, it's over, okay? Even as a myth, Adam and Eve don't even work that well. So, you know, there are other ways to look at, you know, the meaning of Christ in evolution. There's much more expansive ways that are focused on love and not sin, you know? So there was such a, you know, Christians in particular are so kind of guilt-ridden, you know? And I'm like, you got to get over this. We're being in evolution, we're being formed, and we have to think in a different way. We have to think about ourselves in a different way, not as static, but as dynamic becomings, God as becoming with us. We have to reframe our thinking. We cannot remain as static thinkers in a world of change.
You sound like also like CEO of a company that's on the edge of an abyss, going, we've got to disrupt ourselves. We've got to eat our own lunch, otherwise it's going to be eaten for us. And we've got to cross that chasm. So it's fascinating. So we've got a couple of questions. Donald asks, how does God in evolution work with the theological concept of omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent? We touched on some of those, but yeah.
Well, I think, you know, certainly we have to revisit those terms of omnipotence and omniscience. Does God know everything? And I, you know, I do think if God, you know, it sounds to me very deterministic, that all I have to do is just find out what God wants and, you know, all will be well. And we know that just doesn't work that way. And I think, you know, for me, God's...
Well, you were saying like, the Newtonian piece where, you know, you hit a billiard ball and it hits another billiard ball, and people say, well, I've done all the right things. I've gone to church. I've done the things that I was asked, and why am I still stuck with this situation, or why am I in this suffering? It's kind of like it's a trading. It's a ledger, right? I did my side of the ledger. Why am I not getting the other side back?
And just the opposite. And I think God's power, and this is just not mine. I mean, Cardinal Walter Kasper and Jürgen Moltmann and others speak to this. God's power is God's love, God's unconditional love. I think we've got this idea of a Greek God of power, then we impose that on God. But a Christian God of power is a God of love. This is a God who didn't save the son from, you know, a criminal death. This is a God who empowers us through death and darkness into new life, a God who is faithful in love. So God's power, omnipotence, is God's love. God's omniscience is, I think, also rooted in love. Love is a sense, not just I know intellectually what's going to happen, but love is a sense I know you. And I think God's knowledge of us is knowing us in what we have the capacity to be and to become. And that God of fidelity in love, that omniscience, is that fidelity in love. And therefore, I think, you know, that ubiquity of God, that omnipresence of God, is the fidelity of God itself. And no matter where we are and what happens, that God will be, is with us, that deep center of our lives. And that's our hope. That is our future, that no matter what happens, no matter how many bad decisions we make, that God will not leave us, and that God will be with us, and that God is our future.
I'll take the final question from Luca. I guess this is what lots of people would say in response to what you say. Is it too dangerous to say that God changes? Why do we need to say that God is in evolution?
Well, you know, because evolution is about change. And truthfully, if you hold to the incarnation, I mean, a static metaphysics of being would say, no, God's divinity doesn't change, maybe just God's humanity. When in fact, I don't want to split God up into divine human. I think God is a whole, right? And the beauty of God is God loves change, right? I mean, this is not me. Meister Eckhart, the great Dominican mystic, said, God is always new. And he says, you know, God is always new. And when we're united with God, we become new again. A God of change is a God who wants to become something more in us. And I think that doesn't diminish God, because God's godness is, in a sense, not diminished by our becoming. God's godness is enhanced by our becoming. So as we become, God becomes in us more God. And I think someone says, well, how can God become more God? Because God is love. And God's love can never be static. That's all we're saying here. That love is a dynamic love. Otherwise, we have some idea like the Trinity, or like three men sitting around a tea table, you know, and it's all done, all over with, all fixed up. God is always becoming God. It's a dynamism, right? God's love is constantly beginning anew. And how do we know this? From creation. The only way we can know God is here. And anything outside of creation is, in a sense, contrived. That is, I think, what the doctrine of creation is about. Creation is the mirror of divinity. Creation expresses the divine, precisely if we call that God is creator. So anything outside what evolution or what science is telling us would be slightly, I'd have to say, imported from another age.
Ilya, thank you so much for the last hour. It's been fascinating. We've gone in all sorts of crazy directions. Really challenging, I think, and inspiring, and hopeful too. Lots of things to hold on to tightly. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you so much again, Ilya, for joining us.
Thanks for joining us on Wiser Conversations, Together at Home. If you like what you're hearing, please rate and review it today. And if you haven't already, go on and push subscribe. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.